Business is simple. It's just not easy. We focus on three things to help you run and grow your business more easily: talent, sales, and how to scale. Can it be that simple? Talent. Develop a robust recruiting, vetting, and training process to help capable people and then help them to become who and what they want to be. Sales. Have a logical go-to-market strategy. Build the sales and marketing structure and plan around it, and then attack and execute the plan with fanatical consistency. Scale. Know where you're going, why you're going. Share with others why they would want to join you. Be clear on who's allowed to join you and what they'll need to do to stay on board. Anticipate roadblocks. Avoid them before you get stuck. And then when you do hit one, and you will, stay calm, problem solve, and find resources to get unstuck. Sounds simple, right? Simple to understand, but not easy to do. Join us as we focus on the tips and tricks and hacks for running a profitable, hyper-growth business. We'll share real-world horror stories and celebrate the victory sagas that will inspire you. This is the Talent, Sales, and Scale Show. Everyone, Brian Whittington with this episode of the Talent, Sales, and Scale Show. We have Carol Mahoney on from Unbound Growth. So not outbound, not inbound, but unbound, she told me, which is pretty cool. And today we're going to be talking about cognitive behavioral approach to sales performance. What in the world is that, right? So Carol has a whole entire practice around that idea. So welcome to the show, Carol.
Thank you so much for having me here, Brian. I'm excited to talk about this. It's my latest, greatest, favorite obsession.
I love it. So we're obsessed here as well. Now, I got to start off with, usually I ask, why should we listen to you? But we don't even know what in the world cognitive behavioral approach is. So if I can put this into a two-pronged question, one, what is it? And two, why should we listen to you?
So a cognitive behavioral approach is really leveraging and taking whatever thought processes or thoughts or mindsets or attitudes that we have around sales and changing those thoughts so that we then can change our behaviors and then our results. So it's really, if you think about what cognitive behavioral therapy is, it is changing a negative belief and mindset in order to change a behavior and reach our particular goals. And this applies to sales in so very many ways that I'm sure that we will get into.
Okay, so let me just make sure that I understand this. So really, cognitive behavioral coaching is, you have some, as Zig Ziglar used to say, I think it was Zig Ziglar used to say, you got some stinking thinking, right? So your mindset is what's getting in your way. So it's in between the ears, not necessarily a skill, but more of a belief. Is that right?
Yeah. If you think about one of the biggest complaints that sales leaders and business leaders have about sales training is why doesn't it stick? Did you know that we spent, I think, $70 billion in 2017, $70 billion, according to Harvard Business Review in 2017. Now, a year later, CSO still reported for the fifth year in a row that only 54% of salespeople are making quota. So why doesn't sales training stick? Because it's happening between their ears. It's what happens when we know what to do, yet in the moment that we need to do it, we don't.
Yeah, that's a really interesting thought, right? So, it's always challenging as a leader. You look at the sales team and they know what to do, how to do it, even when to do it, but for whatever reason they don't, or they know what to do and they know what not to do, but they still keep repeating it. And so that's why we should listen to you. You have the secret elixir of how in the world to fix this.
I wouldn't say that it's a secret elixir because it's something that's been around for a long time. It's been applied in education. It's been applied in healthcare. And I think it's the reason why a Harvard professor called me a sales therapist. And when you think about, all right, so why listen to me about this? Because I'm certainly not a licensed therapist. I'm just intensely curious about this. And it's funny because I've been coaching Harvard MBA students on coaching and coaching them through sales processes. And the first times I did it at Harvard, I was like, oh, well, okay, there's a first time for everything. But then the second time Harvard asked me to come back and help teach their students, I'm like, okay, so maybe I do know what I'm talking about.
All right. So why should we listen to you? Because you're teaching Harvard students, for goodness sakes. All right.
Yeah.
That might be the best answer I got so far. All right. That works. All right. So how do we do this? I mean, I guess number one is beliefs are challenging, right? We have these cognitive biases that we don't even know that we have a belief issue. So I guess question one is, how in the world do we identify or spot that we have bad thought process? Or maybe another way of saying this is an unsupportive belief system.
Yeah, exactly. And the fact of the matter is that the majority of sellers have this unsupportive belief system. When we surveyed 2 million sales professionals, we found that nearly 80% of sales managers have these non-supportive beliefs. Then if you think about how that impacts their team is 355% more likely to hold those same non-supportive beliefs. There's a flip side, and this is the good news, is that when managers did have supportive beliefs, their team was 1,000% more likely to hold those beliefs, and they perform better as a result. The way that we change it is first by, I call it a self-awareness. But before we can get to a point of self-awareness, we have to identify, why would we even be willing to make a change? What are our personal, meaningful goals that are compelling to us, that is the reason for us to want to become self-aware? To, because self-awareness can be really painful. We're facing our own hidden weaknesses, failures, and belief systems are hard to change because it's something we've developed over our lifetime. It's become a part of who we are. But in psychology, they have something that's called the behavior chain. And when we become aware of something that's not serving us, we then go through a process of identifying, what's the trigger? What is it that's causing this particular thing for me? So for example, it might be my pipeline is low and I have to start making cold calls. That's a trigger, because then it creates a thought process such as, I have to make phone calls, but nobody answers cold calls and nobody wants to hear from me, which then relates to an action of, now I'm going to put off making calls, which is a result of then having a skinny pipeline. That's how it might play out in sales. But the way we start to change it is by becoming that self-awareness and then figuring out what's the trigger and changing the thought. We can't just stop doing it. We have to replace it with something that's supportive. And this is something that we do through coaching, in practice, in role play, in assessing and reviewing our own calls. It's something that happens in small pieces over time, but can have drastic and immediate impact.
Okay. I was on mute, off mute, and you probably heard me typing there. I was off mute whenever I thought I was on. So it's identify the trigger, then change the non-supportive belief or non-supportive thought process, and actively or proactively create an intentional supportive thought process. Is that really what you're saying there?
Yeah. So I'll give you an example. Oh, yesterday was my birthday, by the way. And for my
birthday
last year, thank you very much. For my birthday last year, I decided that I was going to get healthy. And so since then I've lost 76 pounds. And
thank
you. But what was interesting about it is that as I was going through the program, and by the way, and I'm not getting paid to say this in any way, the program I used was Noom. And so if you've heard of the Noom ads, they say how to make weight loss stick, how to use a cognitive behavioral approach to weight loss. The same research they use, the same process they use that I use to lose 76 pounds is the same one that I use with sellers. So for example, for me, one of my triggers is that whenever I would sit down to eat lunch or breakfast, or sometimes even dinner, I would have some screen in front of me, whether it was the television, my TV, or my phone. And because of that, my thought was, I'm just eating and getting through it as quickly as I can, which meant I ate fast and I usually ate more than I should have, which was a result of me gaining more weight. So by changing the trigger, in this case, by not having the phone in front of me, the thought process was, now I can sit and actually enjoy what's going on in my meal and enjoy how it tastes. That thought led to the action of me eating slower, which means the result of I ate less. Simple little tiny things that can be done to change a behavior then changes the result.
So really what you're combining here, a buddy of mine always used to call me a book snob, but I like to take application of these books. So really what you're talking about is, if we take the Heath's book, The Switch, where it talks about, you know, the elephant, the rider, and the path.
Absolutely.
It's changing the environment. And then if we throw on a little bit of atomic habits, then it's mm-hmm. change the environment, create those habit stacks, or maybe what you said is you removed one habit stack and put on a different one on top of it. So, and that's the beauty about this is what I'm finding, Carol, is there's really nothing terribly new.
Yeah.
But it's the application of all of these different disparate thoughts and pulling it together into what will work. So let's take this down to maybe a sales piece. And I don't know if this would be comfortable to do it on a hiring piece or yeah. even a scaling of the business piece. So let's talk sales first and see if we can maybe make application of these thoughts to these other parts. So let's first identify what are the most common non-supportive beliefs or non-supportive thoughts that we in sales have?
So some of the most common ones are people need to like me to buy from me. Is I think probably the biggest one. We are as human beings wired to want people to like us because that's how we survived in tribes for the beginning of time. So if people don't like us, they won't buy from us is a very prominent thought process. Yes,
now,
people can't
if I might,
you're a jerk.
If I might
confident.
Yep, if I might piggyback off of that. So because of that, so one might argue, well, that's actually a good thing. To your point, right? It's good that people like me. So let's talk about some of the negative realities that happen from that non-supportive of, I have to be liked. We call it high need for approval. So
yes.
What are some of the negative consequences of that, Carol?
So as a seller, it's a negative consequence because then you will not ask tough questions of your prospect. You will not confront them or challenge their way of thinking, which then means you become that yes man or woman. You're just going to say yes to whatever. Everything's going to be wonderful. We're the greatest. We can do whatever you say, which makes it difficult for people to trust you. The other thing is that as managers who suffer from this, they won't have those accountability, tough conversations with their sellers. And so mediocrity will abound. And then we can go on and up the chain because that also filters down from the CRO, from even the CEO, that when these things are present, it is going to impact how they handle and manage those conversations with their teams, how they handle conflict.
Okay. Yeah. And I like that. So they won't handle conflict. So from a manager, I'm not going to hold my people accountable. If I'm a salesperson, I'm going to get a bloated pipeline because anything can get into it. I'm a professional visitor yet, you know, I have super skinny kids running around because I can't feed them because I'm not selling anything. You know, they'll invite me over for their kids, birthday party, but they're never buying from me. I'm just a super nice person that they like. And I'd rather be like than respected. I'd rather be liked than win. Is that kind of the...
Exactly. The like versus respected piece mostly. And the other part of it, it impacts many things. So it impacts your ability to ask tough questions. It impacts your ability to get to decision makers. It impacts your ability, you know, recovering from rejection is another one of those things that has a slight impact there, but it's one of those things that we're not going to solve for overnight. And in the context of sales, it's going to be a constant battle for 99.9% of sellers and managers.
And my sense is that would probably play itself out on the scaling, right? Because if I need to now put systems and processes in place to scale my business and people are pushing back on it, I'd rather be liked than enforce these new procedures that nobody's going to want to change anyway. So it's going to be hard for them. And then from a hiring side, I'm going to hire people just like me as opposed to the right person. Is that a good adaptation?
Exactly. And also on the need for approval and need to be liked part in the hiring piece of it, I see this all the time that happens in sales, especially when HR is concerned about things like how they're going to be reviewed on Glassdoor, is that they'll go through the sales process and it'll be very nice and comfortable and everyone is, you know, oh, so nice and wonderful. And it's easy, except that when a salesperson then gets into the role, it's not going to be anything like that. So, you know, having a tough interview process where you're qualifying people out early and not being overly nice is a difficult thing sometimes in that hiring process, especially where, and I understand HR is going to be concerned, but at the same time, you want to make sure you have people that are going to be able to handle the tough sales environment that they're going to be in. Yeah. So it impacts it in the interview process, in the hiring and selection process, and as you said, the systems and processes.
Yeah, a quick tactic, you could love it or hate it off of that one, is I always, whenever we're interviewing, I say, listen, what I don't want to do is the candidate campaign speech, right? With what's going on right now in the election and everything else, I don't want to do the candidate campaign speech where you elect me and then once elected, you find out who I truly am and I'm not anything like the candidate. So being authentic and real throughout, I think is really important. And that likely goes to the sales and the scaling part too. Okay. So high need for approval, that need to be liked. That's the first one that comes to mind. What are a couple of other ones maybe?
A couple of other ones, and that I think are very common today, is I need to educate my prospects. And with that belief comes the tell versus ask scenario. So when you believe that you need to educate your prospects, a lot of times the next action that comes to play is that you're going to tell them about every feature and every benefit and why they should buy from you over the competition. And you're going to dump a ton of information on them because you need to tell them everything. And then prospects and buyers get overwhelmed. They don't make a decision. Or worse yet, they feel like buyers or sellers aren't listening to them because they're just telling them everything that they think that they need to know without ever asking them what their thoughts, opinions, or perspectives are on it.
That's a great one. I would never have thought of that. And you are so right, because we call it feature dumping, or, you know, the crass way of saying it is I show up and throw up. And they're so ecstatic about their products or service and laying this stuff out. They fail to realize, listen, this is like you giving a slideshow on, this is like you giving a slideshow about your vacation that no one cares about. So love that one. That's great. Never thought of that one. How about some others?
So the other one, and this is one of the ones that's actually the easiest to fix, is I call it the how you buy is how you sell dynamic. So if you believe that you need to research, that you have to have the best price before you can get something, all of these will cause you to then be sympathetic to buyers who need to do their research, who need to think it over for a long time, who need to compare every feature and price and need to have the best price, because that's how you would do it. And so with sellers, then what happens is you get a longer cycle that's overinflated pipeline. And what happens is then you also find yourself in the race to the bottom of who's going to give the biggest discount. And this is a major problem. Instead of selling on value, you're selling on price. You're accepting the put offs. You're not uncovering compelling reasons or urgency for them to make any kind of a change. Because the other part of that is that you think people who are going to think it over will eventually buy from you, because you know what? It's logical. We're the best solution. Why wouldn't they buy from us? That's pretty rampant as well.
Yeah. There's so much we could go on that one. So, all right. From a hiring perspective, how can we avoid getting somebody with how you buy is how you sell? Because if I ask somebody, hey, are you decisive? They're going to say, oh yeah, you betcha. I'm super decisive. Right. So how do we find that out, for goodness sakes?
So the hiring process that we recommend is a scientific-based one, and we have a third-party assessment tool that we use that will pre-screen for this. And This isn't something, it's not a personality test or even a how you communicate or see the world kind of a thing. This is a very sales-specific, how will you be able to perform in this environment?
Now, are you using OMG or what are you using there?
Yes. Okay. So we're OMG partners And we have seen clients who have gone from a 50-50% hiring success rate to over 75%, some even reaching 90% mm-hmm. of predictable success, because you can screen and then not spend your time interviewing people who are going to either not be able to overcome those things or have enough strengths necessary that it makes up for hidden weaknesses that you can address in onboarding, training, and coaching. There is no such thing as the perfect salesperson. Let's just put that out there. It does not exist. It is the mythical unicorn at the end of the rainbow with a pot of gold eating Hershey's bars all day long.
Yeah.
Doesn't happen, but you can find the right best fit for your company, your market, your buyer, your environment. Just because someone was successful at your competitors does not mean that they will be successful in your industry, in your company. Different dynamics. I see one of the things that happens is that companies will bring in or poach salespeople from other companies because that's their direct competitor, not knowing that maybe they're a top performer because they had the best territory. or that they'd inherited certain accounts, that they might not actually have the skills, but you don't know that because you're just hiring them based off of past performance without having the context. So to avoid getting sellers who have too much need for approval or believe they need to educate buyers or supportive buy cycle beliefs, screen them first. Be specific about the role that you want and evaluate objectively for that. And then the other piece of it is that because you're never going to find the perfect salesperson who doesn't have some beliefs that hang them up, is that when you screen for those that are coachable, you'll know that you can then, through this cognitive behavioral coaching and training, help them to overcome those things. And through that, you gain top sellers who are going to stay with you longer. You get higher retention in your customers, shorter sales cycles, greater margins, and everybody's happier.
Got it. So far we have need to be liked. I need to educate my prospects. How I buy is how I'm going to sell. What other ones do we need to know about?
So the other one that is a large one, I mean, obviously there's recovering from rejection. I think that goes without saying, but some of the others that I see that sellers are struggling with, especially with the uncertainty today, is, the emotional control, emotional involvement. And some of the beliefs are, I don't have any control over my life. I don't have any control over my sales process, or I need to be able to answer everybody's questions as soon as they ask them. Some of these beliefs can feed into us getting emotionally involved and attached to things. Also, the belief if people think it over, they're going to eventually buy from me feeds into sort of this emotional involvement that prevents them from being present in the moment. So by not being present in the moment, they're not actively listening. If they're not actively listening, then they're not uncovering real needs, real problems, and urgency, because they're not going to be asking the questions that dig deeper into those things.
Okay, so having emotional control, not playing the part of the victim, how quickly we're recovering from rejection, how we buy is how we sell. I need to educate my prospects and I need to be liked. So those are all the negatives. So let's take the first one. I need to be liked. What's the supportive belief, or what's the supportive thought that we should use there?
Is to seek respect rather than approval.
Okay. So changes to seek respect or approval. And then, right, I need to educate my prospects changes to what?
I need to ask the questions to uncover what it is that they need to solve for.
Okay. So I need to ask questions. How I buy is how I sell. So that's a curious one. So what do we want? What's the proper thought process there?
So a different thought process there is changing how we make decisions of instead of thinking I need to have the best price, I need to have the price that fits in my budget. So there are individual thoughts there. If, for example, if your belief in that is I need to do a lot of research, then the thought is I find out what I need to know and only look for three different places for it.
Okay. So, maybe a couple of things out of that. So, I buy on value, not price. So if I'm a price shopper, maybe I buy on value, not price. Or if I'm a slow decision maker because I have to do a bunch of research, I'm confident at 80%, or, you know, those type of things. Is it just a little bit of self-talk repeated over and over and over again to change those, is what you're saying?
Sometimes it's self-talk, but sometimes you also, this is where a coach comes in, is that you need a coach to be able to ask you questions, to be able to get you to reverse backwards. So by working with a coach who's using a cognitive behavioral approach will apply a couple of different levers. So one of them is the logic of, if I need to do a lot of research, logically speaking, which one are you thinking of going with? And logically speaking, how much more are you going to be able to find out if you do all of this research? Is it really going to change your decision? If the answer is no, then logically speaking, you don't need to do all of this research. Another technique could be kind of the unraveling of things, finding out where does this belief come from? So if you believe I need to have the best price, where does that come from? Well, I grew up in a family that was always pinching pennies and cutting coupons. And if we didn't get something for the best price, it was a negative, something bad was going to happen to the family. Okay, so then let's apply a little bit of logic to that. Are you in that situation today? No. So it's this is where the therapy part of it comes in, is as a coach, you have to have the patience to be able to ask the questions that help the coachee to dig into where is this coming from for me and what is the thought I need to replace it with.
Okay, so with that said, logic can only do so many things, right? Because this is, we unfortunately would like to justify everything logically, but then we make the decisions emotionally. So how do we then go from that logical, getting them to understand that, to come up? My guess is we're using that logic to get to a sense of self-awareness.
Right.
Then from that self-awareness, how do we then get them to that emotional reason to change? Because that's, we can, no matter what, I can motivate you for a short term, right? But then afterwards, as soon as I turn my back or go somewhere else, unless if I'm over you all the time until that becomes a habit, which takes a long time,
yeah,
you're going to revert back to your own ways unless if you have your self motivation. So how do I go from that logic to helping you to emotionally self motivate?
Yeah. So you might go this way. You might start by applying logic so that they can become self-aware. Then you might further dig into that self-awareness by asking those unraveling questions. Where does this come from? When do you first remember thinking this way? And then one of the things that I like to do is then, to your point about the motivation piece of it, is the end play. All right, so if you continue doing it this way or thinking this way, what's happened in the past when you've done that? How is this going to play out for you when you're trying to get this deal in? Because for you, again, this goes back to what is their personally meaningful goal? And how is this going to help you to reach that personally meaningful goal if you don't make this change?
Got it. Okay, so I don't know if you've ever used this before, but there's almost like a T chart, right? If you put a T down, and on one side you put all the good, on the other side you put all the bad. So on that chart, you can lay out, hey, what's all the good things about you changing this? What's all the bad things that's going to happen if you don't change it? Have them circle the ones that are most motivating to them to figure out if they're pain or pleasure motivated. And then that's a way that we can get them to dwell on the emotional reason why they're going to change. Is that a good way of going down there?
And that's why we use the objective management group evaluations for hiring and for training and for coaching, because it's not enough to just identify what their personally meaningful goals are. But that T that you're describing is actually what the evaluation and assessment does for them, is it helps to, one, create the self-awareness of what are my specific beliefs? How are they getting in my way? What do I need to replace it with? And then that T that you're talking about, that's actually what we do, is we call it their individual action plan. Okay. What are the strengths that you have in which areas that have gotten you to where you are? And where are the weaknesses that we need to work on? What are the implications? And then how are we going to address it in our day-to-day? So they're collaborating in what this needs to be. So it's not someone coming in and telling them, like a therapy session would work. We're getting their buy-in as to what that needs to be. And then when we're going through like deal progressions, or when we're looking at skill sets, I have this thing, I call it the dirty laundry list. So it's kind of like how you describe the tea. I want a list of all of the reasons of why a deal has gone south before, what made it go south, and we like de-diagnose it that way. And I have them keep a running list as that reminder of the end play. What's going to happen if we continue doing it this way?
Yeah.
I love it when sellers come to me with calls and they're like all excited and it's going to be, and I hate to be the wet blanket. And I'm like, so have you ever had it happen before when a buyer has said that to you and nothing ever happened? Yeah.
Yeah. Right. So we always used to joke around in my old days. We'd say, you know, how'd the call go? Oh, it went great. Okay. Got it. You didn't sell anything either. Right. Cause it went great is, hey, we talked about this, this, and this. Here are the next steps. Here are the reasons why they're going to go forward. So if they can't get that specificity, oh, you didn't sell anything either. So, oh my gosh, we hear it all the time. We like sit there and we're sucking on hopium, waiting for the deal to go through, for goodness sake. So, all right. So what else do we need to know? I mean, this is some really good things. So, really what we're doing is taking these non-supportive beliefs, figuring out what those non-supportive beliefs are, and then I guess the question is, how do we become self-aware of these? So the assessment tool is one, mm-hmm. but if I'm not willing to pony up or call you to do this assessment, Because they're not that expensive. Well, actually, with OMG, you have to buy the license there, but can they go
through it? It depends on what you're doing for hiring. It depends on the number of people that you're hiring. And then for current teams, there's two different sides to it. And it's the cost of the assessment is not even close to the cost of the 50% of salespeople who aren't going to make quota in your company without some type of training and coaching.
If I'm an individual, can I come to you? And
yes.
Okay, got it. So, you know, reach out to Carol, for goodness sakes, get an OMG test.
But here's the other side of this as well, is that the data, the OMG test is the data, right? And it's the best data that there is out there as far as sales performance goes and what leads to predictable performance. But it's still just data because you have to be able to put it into context. And like any data, a scientific method would see how it observes in the field. So if someone comes to me, I've had this happen before where you've evaluated teams and someone on the team says, I don't believe what this evaluation says about me because I want to know which question I answered that made it say this particular thing. And I'm never going to try to convince someone that the data is right and they are wrong. But what I am going to do is as we go through coaching and I observe things, and I've had this happen where we've gone a month or 2 months into coaching and we start to observe the symptoms of what's happening. I say, okay, can you go back into your evaluation and read out loud to me what page 16 says about why this is happening?
Yeah.
And eventually they're, you know, if they're open and coachable and motivated, it doesn't take very long for them to see, oh, I see now why this keeps happening to me.
Yeah. My favorite one is we use Outmatch at our place because Dave Curlin, I wasn't allowed to buy OMG stuff. So we're, I did score a 99 on there. So that was cool. He goes, you cheated. I said, yeah.
Yeah, maybe that's why. Yeah.
Right? So we use Outmatch and it's kind of funny because one of the ones that they have is called self-awareness, right? Mm-hmm. Or excuse making. And they go, I don't make excuses. All right. And, you know, sure enough, you just whip that out a couple of weeks later. So unbelievable. So yeah, there's a lot of good stuff. And if you're not using something to get the x-rays, MRIs, exactly. I think you're really messing up. Okay. So, but so other than taking these assessments, how else can we become self-aware?
So, you know, this is one of the small silver linings that I have discovered through the pandemic is one of the other ways that you can start to become self-aware is to slow the F down. and there's a book recommendation that I have for this that's called Deep Work. I think it's Cal Newton. And one of the things that I kind of took away from this and again, like we were talking before, like I limit how much time I spend on social media. I say no more often than I say yes, because I went from saying yes to everything to now I'm going to focus on the things that are the highest importance and priority to my particular purpose. And that is how we start to become self-aware is it's small little pieces that we do it. You know, I could tell you to meditate or do yoga or go for long walks, but all of these are things and activities to try to get you to slow the F down is really what it's all about. So turning off the notifications on your phone and your email, you don't need to see every email chime as it comes in. Life is not going to stop because you didn't answer the email within 3 minutes of it being sent to you. The world is still going to keep turning if you don't update your Facebook and Instagram every hour. And I understand personal brand is important, but not at the sake of your mental health.
Yeah. So
and your sales performance.
So you were right on that Deep Work, Cal Newport. Yep. And, you know, to your point, it really lays out, you know, what you should do on a daily basis, where you should set aside time to really think through this. Okay, great. So Deep Work, take the assessments, slow the F down. I like that. What else do we need to do?
You can't impress the importance enough of setting your own personally meaningful goals. And there are worksheets that are on my website that I use with clients to help guide and walk them through that process. And we all understand what SMART goals are, but it's not about setting specific and measurable and attainable, all of those. It's really about identifying what's meaningful to you. And that's part of that slowing the up down and that creating that self-awareness to be able to know what that is. And it's a process whereby you think about what are the things important to you? Where do you want your daily life to look like feel like, smell like, and who's with you at these particular points in your life. Those are the things that we find out are really important to us. When we, to The Artist's Way, to another book to recommend, about asking those six layers of why. Why is this important to me? Why is this important to me? Why is this important to me? And then taking that and saying, all right, if that's not where I am now, which is a creating of cognitive dissonance, which is we have a reality and we have a goal, and in between is this gap that if we're motivated, we'll do whatever it takes to reach that, bridge that gap. So goal setting is creating stress for ourselves so that we can achieve something greater.
Yeah.
And going through and quantifying that is not as difficult as people need to make it out to be. Like, for example, my personally meaningful goal is to be as completely self-sufficient off the grid as I can, because I was raised in a family to be independent, to be in nature, to never leave a mark, and to be able to sustain yourselves. This is just how I was raised. So for me, that means things like having solar panels and enough land that I can farm and have chickens and do all of these things so that I can have that feeling of security and safety and self-sufficiency. It costs money to put solar panels on and buy land and do all of these things. So it can become quantifiable, and you can create an action plan for that. And I share it with the people that are closest to me. I'm sharing it with everybody now who's listening, and I want you to hold me accountable. Stalk me on Instagram and you'll see all of the updates as they come. That's how we set personally meaningful goals. We think about what's important to us. We write it down. We create action commitments about what it's going to take for us to do it. We share it with other people, and we make ourselves accountable to those people on a regular basis.
Okay. So
do it every way.
Yeah. Take what Carol said right there, and that's gold, because what most people do is they make these dreams. They're not goals. They're dreams, because there's no time frame to them. And then worse yet, there's no plan to attack. And then worse yet, there's no accountability for you not attacking the plan. And then worse yet, you're not sharing successes with anybody. Nobody knows what you're working on, so nobody can help you. So that, take what Carol said there. That is gold, gold, gold. I love it. So by the way, I'm hanging out with you for the rest of the pandemic so I can eat and not have to raise chickens on my own.
I know. Well, you know what? I tell people this so much that I'm going to have to put a disclaimer that if you want to come here, you're going to work. And so just bring a tent and a shovel and you'll work your way through it.
Well, I don't know where you live. You're in Maine. I'm not coming up there in a tent. Jesus.
Exactly. Right. So I don't have to worry. I'll be in a snow before Christmas.
All right. Got it. So what else do we need to know? So we're self-aware now. We have we figured out what these negative thoughts are. And now you talked about a behavior chain. Let's unpack that a little bit. So what I understand from that behavior chain is the first part of that behavior chain is to identify the triggers. Second one is to change the thoughts around those triggers. And then third one is act according to those new thoughts. Is that the behavior chain?
Yes. So think of it as trigger, thought, action, result.
Okay. Let me write that down. Trigger, thought, action, result.
Right. And so being self-aware, that helps you to identify what the triggers are. Okay. And the thoughts are two-part, right? Identifying what is the thought that happens as a result of the trigger. And then what am I going to need to change that to? And then what is the behavior? So the bad thought and the bad behavior, they're linked together. The good thought and the desired behavior, we want to link that together to get a different result. Sometimes we can change the trigger or the environment. Sometimes we can't. And so we have to create strategies for ourselves around that.
Yeah.
You know, like for example, when we apply it to weight loss, I can't sometimes change the fact that my nephew's birthday party is just pizza and ice cream everywhere. I can't change what they're going to be serving, but I can create a strategy for myself and bring healthy snacks with me, or decide I'm going to have only one piece of this particular thing so that I can still get the result that I want. Same thing here is you as an individual need to be able to figure out what is my action going to be if I can't change the trigger. If you're an SDR and you don't like making cold calls, you're not going to be able to change that. You have right. to figure out a way to change your thought process and have a strategy to get over that.
Yeah. And what you just pointed out there is you take emotional control. Yeah. I can get right. all bent out of shape over my sister or in-laws or whoever, you know, having this stuff that, you know, they know that I'm trying to lose weight. Yeah. They don't care. right? And it's, so it's up to you. If, I mean, figure it out, eat less that day or do something about it. So I love that. And then the other curious thing that I found out recently is that, in order for us to change our results, most people say, well, if you want to change results, you have to change your thoughts, which are yes, but those thoughts need to lead to the actions, like you just said.
Right.
So in order for me to change my results, I need to change my actions. But in order for me to change my beliefs, my results need to change. Because if I'm if I'm acting differently, but the results aren't changing, I'm actually reinforcing those non-supportive beliefs. So we have to see those results change. So get some help to make sure that we get these results changed to get you on the right path. Go ahead.
So I absolutely love that you brought that, because I wanted to make sure that we got to that part of it, is especially if you're a manager listening in, is that this is why it's important to celebrate the small wins and focus on leading indicators. Hmm. I call it doing the work and focusing on the process, because
can you define leading indicators? Because there's probably a lot of people that don't know leading and lagging.
Yeah. So a leading indicator is a metric or something that leads to a lagging indicator. So for example, if one of the metrics that you're tracking in your sales process is the number of meetings booked, let's just start at the very beginning of the funnel. What are the leading indicators, the things that need to happen in order for that meeting to get booked? Number of calls made, number of people reached. And if you want to dig down even deeper to see even more leading indicators, number of questions asked during the call, amount of talk time spent, level of engagement back and forth. These are leading indicators that will tell you what the next metric, how and why that's happening. Because that's one of the issues when we're trying to tie sales training and coaching ROI to results, sales closed, is that we don't always know, one, what we're coaching to impact that leading indicator. And so that's why pipelines aren't very predictable and accurately forecast. So that's what a leading and lagging indicators are. And when we think about that, we need, like to your point, if the results that we're getting are still negative, I'm still not getting enough meetings booked. And that's the thing that we focus on as managers, it's going to demotivate your sellers. It's going to reinforce their negative beliefs, which is why focusing on small changes and celebrating those small wins is what will give them the confidence to be able to do more.
Yeah.
What I typically see happen when we start engaging in cognitive behavioral coaching is that in the first couple of weeks, it's the self-awareness, identifying the triggers. How does that particularly play out? Then we start to, through coaching, start to see small changes in things like number of questions being asked, the strength, the short, the brevity, the insightfulness of those questions being asked. We start to see other little changes like asking for next steps in the call and following up more consistently. We start to see small behavioral changes. Celebrate those. However that person likes to be recognized, because then they're going to start to be willing to make even bigger changes, to take bigger risks to them than they'd ever done before.
Yeah. And that is gold right there. If you get nothing out of this, which I'm getting a ton, you got to take that. Those leading and lagging indicators, because to your point, Carol, now I know those numbers will tell me a story.
Right.
Right. That, because I can't do anything about a lack of sales today, because that lack of sales today, depending on your sales cycle, is weeks, if not months in arrears. And it goes back probably to your hiring process. So all of those stack up. So I need those leading and lagging indicators, and some leading indicators are actually lagging indicators for other leading indicators. And I can coach, mentor, and train to each one of those. So I love it, love it, love it. So son of a gun, I could talk here all day. So we got to wind this down. So let me ask you this. I mean, you've given a ton of just great content here, and I can't thank you enough for this. You know, what's one of the biggest challenges, whether that you've faced or that you see your people face, that we can learn and avoid doing those same things? Can you share with us something so we don't hurt ourselves doing the same foolish things?
If we're going to talk about the beginning of all of this in hiring, because people are starting to hire, there's a lot of marketplace full of sellers that are out there, is that don't go into hiring with the, I need to find someone as fast as possible. Mm. Go into the hiring with, I need to find the best fit, the best salesperson possible right now. And don't hire someone off of subjective criteria. hire them off of objective criteria. So subjective being things like, I want someone who's really curious. How do we measure that? And have you ever had someone who's really curious not perform as a salesperson? If the answer is yes, then that's not predictable as to whether or not they're going to be successful in the role. So use criteria that can be measured and that are going to tie directly to success in the role. Again, if you've had people in the sales role before who have been curious and detail oriented but have still failed, then maybe we need to look at some different criteria there. Yeah, I think that's the biggest pothole that people are going to be facing in the next 3 to 6 months.
I love it. And, you know, how many salespeople are running around being the most detail-oriented people in the world, right? So I think they're called engineers. All right. Now, you laid out a couple of all kinds of hacks for talent sales and scale, so we'll skip that one. You recommended a resource, and I missed it. So you said deep work. We talked about that one. Yes. What was the other one where we're asking the whys? What was that one, please?
The Artist's Way, I believe, that's what that one is called. And if we're adding other books that I would recommend for people, and this kind of ties to how I see the future of sales going in the next year or so, I would highly recommend... he's going to love me because I've been doing this a lot, is The Code of Trust.
Ooh, okay.
It's not a sales book. You can see all my sticky notes there. It was written by Robin Dreek, who is an FBI, CIA counterintelligence agent. And he trained CIA and FBI in how to build rapport and how to build trust. In counterterrorism units. So he's convincing people who to spy for us, basically. And I've said to him many times, I'm like, this could be the best sales book ever, but it's not a sales book. But it relates to how we build trust with our teams internally. And this can be done virtually. It applies to how salespeople can build trust with their sellers. It's not enough to be trustworthy. You have to communicate being trustworthy. And I predict that this is going to become absolutely paramount, especially in 2021, because that is how we're going to bridge the gaps between buyer and seller and all of the other things that we are seeing going on around us.
I really like that. So I'm definitely going to go out and get that. It's like the Chris Voss for negotiating is this guy for rapport building and building a trust. Yeah. Because back to your thought earlier, one of the biggest negative self-talks or self-limiting beliefs that we have is that need to be liked. It's that need to be liked. It's not, yes, respected. But I think another synonym for that is being trusted.
Yeah.
Because if I respect you, I trust you.
Exactly.
So I think that's killer. I can't wait to read that. Thank you for that. All right. So you've laid out a couple of things. So what's the future hold? What do we need to watch out for that's going to whack us if we're not paying attention?
I think the thing that we need to look out for that's going to whack us is the propensity for our sellers and managers to blame the economy for whatever results that they're getting. And not to say that there are, like, if you're in hospitality right now, there's some things that are out of your control for sure. But the ability for you to, I hate to use the word pivot, but that is exactly what people are doing, is pivoting and shifting to be able to find those opportunities that are still apparent for you. You have to not accept the excuse that it's the economy. It's the economy.
Yes. I love that one, Carol, because you know what? It is reality. A lot of us are getting just hammered right now. So in that reality, what are we going to do about it? Because there has to be action taken, whether it's reduction of force, which sucks, or a pivot to different, right? Different partners, products, services, whatever the case may be. But you surviving means that you pivot, adjust, and are more agile than others. And sitting there sucking your thumb on the side of the road is not going to help you to get past this. So we got to raise chickens. We got to buy some more land and get some solar power out there. Come on, fellas.
Exactly. For any of you that are in HR that are looking for a benefits program, I know someone that has a benefits program that teaches people to do exactly that, raise chickens and have gardens so they can supply their own food, because you know what? It actually is really good for you mental health-wise. It helps you relax you. It's good for your physical activity, all good things. And I think that the thing to focus on instead of it's the economy, to your point, what are we going to do next? Focus on the work, focus on the process and not on the outcome, because you can't control the outcome. And so when you say it's the economy, that's the reason why I can't do anything. You're not doing the work.
Yeah. Love it. And yes, love it. All right. So what you don't know right now, Carol, is I have my screaming goat socks on, so that was appropriate for today. So are you raising goats over there?
So.
What's that?
And I have no socks on.
Oh, son of a gun, rub it in. You're a minimalist, so that's awesome.
If I could be barefoot all the time, I probably would be.
There you go. I love it. So, hey, who should reach out to you, Carol? How should they do it, and why should they reach out to you?
I think sellers who are struggling with it's the economy right now, or you're in a new role, certainly reach out to me. And then managers that are trying to figure out how to coach and train their sellers up virtually. And then directors, CEOs that you're trying to help to support those managers, those teams, understanding who can and will improve on our team, who should we be hiring and doing so predictably. All of them can go to my website at unboundgrowth.com. Or reach out to me through there. They can schedule an appointment right there on the website to get on the calendar.
Great. Carol, this has been an awesome show. I can't thank you enough for your insights and definitely reach out. So again, that was Unbound Growth. On behalf of Carol Mahoney, Unbound Growth, this is Brian Whittington with the Talent Sales and Scale Show. Get after it. It's not the economy. Get after it. It's the execution of your behavior to get your goals. Thanks, everyone. See ya.